Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your hometown bookstore. This evening's event was brought to you with the help of the Denver Public Library Friends Foundation. We'd like to thank the Friends Foundation for making this event possible, and we'd also like to extend the invitation to the director of the Friends Foundation, Melinda Lloyd, to introduce our very special guest. Would you please join me in welcoming Melinda?
Thank you. As he said, I am Melinda Lloyd, and I am director of the Friends Foundation at the Denver Public Library. And I just have to say that the reception that we had prior to this part of the event was just fabulous, an opportunity to mingle with Carlotta and her family. And it was an opportunity for us as the staff of the Friends Foundation, as well as our city librarian, Shirley Amore, and some of her staff, to thank the Tattered Cover and to really show our appreciation for all that they do for the community every single day. I'd also like to thank Charles, wherever he went. He has just done a great job in helping us put this together. On to our very special guest, Carlotta Walls Lanier. Let me tell you just a couple of things. At age 14, Carlotta was the youngest of the nine black students that became known as the Little Rock Nine. The message of hope, courage, and inspiration that she just exemplifies is as relevant now as it was in 1957. She got swept into the spotlight and into the history books at that time. Her fascinating personal story offers an inside look into that journey. When Carlotta signed her name on a simple sheet of paper that passed around the ninth grade class at her all-black school, where she expressed an interest in going to the all-white school, she had no idea what she was getting herself into. She was just expressing that interest. Yet, she was changing the course of her life, that of her family, and that of countless students for generations to come. She truly demonstrates that the ability to change the world is truly in all of us. Carlotta Walls Lanier is a recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor and sits on the board of the University of Northern Colorado. Go Bears. She founded the real estate brokerage firm Lanier & Company, and she lectures worldwide. Please join me in welcoming our extra special guest, Carlotta Walls Lanier.
Oh, thank you. Now, please. Thank you. Thank you very much for that warm welcome. And thank you, Melinda, for that introduction. And Charles, I again thank you for all that you have done to make this possible in working with the Denver Public Library Foundation, the Friends Foundation. Unfortunately, those two or three rows in the back, I didn't get that extra time to thank you on a personal basis, but I recognize that as I was signing books at another event that I didn't have enough time to at least thank you for taking your time to come and support me and hear what I had to say and to purchase my book. And believe me, I'm very, very grateful to that for that. I also, but before I get started, I really would like to introduce to you those people that are very, very dear to me. And, okay, first being my mother, Juanita Walls. Mother, would you please stand? It's three girls in our family. I'm the oldest. The next daughter is Luana Walls Terry. And my youngest sister is still trying to run things, even though she's retired. She's in the back of the room by the name of Tina Walls. And it goes without saying, my wonderful husband, Ike Lanier, in the back. And one of my two children, my daughter, Brooke Lanier, who has come in from New York to be with me today. Thank you very much for making them feel welcome as well. This story of my high school days is not about the first integration to take place in the South. It is, however, about a school integration which found its way repeatedly into the national spotlight, a showdown between states' rights and federal law, between the Arkansas governor and President Eisenhower, of the United States, between nine kids who wanted to go to school but had to be accompanied by 1,200 soldiers to escort them inside the building. It was the fall of 1957, and what happened to us in Little Rock would become the second biggest news story of the year, second only to the launch of Sputnik and Eisenhower's biggest domestic crisis of his presidency. I will read tonight from three places in the book, a few pages from the prologue, then about entering the school and how I classified the groups that I encountered in my days inside the school, and finally a few pages that will introduce the most horrific night of my life. The night my home was bombed my senior year. According to our local daily Arkansas Gazette, I was the first integrating student in the country to have her home bombed. Few people my age still have more than one good friend from high school. I'm grateful to have at least eight: Ernie, Melba, Minnie Jean, Elizabeth, Gloria, Terry, Jefferson, and Thelma. In the public mind, we are one, the Little Rock Nine. But we are, in essence, nine distinct personalities with nine different stories. This book shares mine. It is much a story about the dedication of family, perseverance, and sacrifice, as it is about history. It is a salute to my parents, Cartellu and Juanita Walls, who stayed silently in the background and swallowed great risk and suffering. They were the ones who had ingrained in me the quiet confidence that, Jim Crow be damned, I was not a second-class citizen. It was that confidence that told me I deserved the quality education the Supreme Court said I was due. The confidence that steadied my feet to defy the racists with my mere presence at school every single day. My parents bequeathed to me the confidence of their fathers, both hardworking black entrepreneurs in control of their own economic lives. My family may have seemed unlikely candidates for involvement in a movement that would spark nationwide change. But then again, that is the point of this book: to show that determination, fortitude, and the ability to move the world aren't reserved for this special people. I'm going to read from chapter 6, The Blessings the blessing of walls. To my surprise, getting inside Central was just the beginning of a brand new struggle finding a way to survive. So much of my energy had been focused on gaining access to the school that it hadn't really occurred to me what daily life would be like on the inside. I wanted to believe that the cold stares, the name-calling, and taunts I had experienced on the first day would soon melt away, that the mobs would disappear for good now that the U.S. military's best stood guard, that the student troublemakers would find their attention elsewhere, that eventually Central would embrace me. It wouldn't take long for those hopes to fade. I gave out my card to someone. And sometimes I've thought about how much easier survival would have been if more people had taken a stand. As I saw it, the students at Central fell into different categories. The smallest group was the easiest to identify. Those students who were determined to make our lives miserable, the tormentors, the black leather boys, their female cohorts, and the other cowardly students who clung to their groups in their evil efforts to push us out. They were the ones who called us derisive names, spat on us, kicked us, hit, pushed, and slammed us into lockers and down the stairs. Maybe it was their parents who helped to make up the segregationist crowds that clung to the wrong-headed belief that Central somehow belonged to them and that the nine of us were the interlopers causing trouble by having the audacity to keep showing up. The second group included those students who were clearly sympathetic, even if they did not outwardly show it or jump to our defense in times of trouble. You could tell by the kind eyes that on our worst days seemed to say, "I'm really sorry this is happening to you." Sometimes they offered a shy smile in the hallways or in class, or slipped a quiet note of support to one of us undercover. Gloria has talked fondly about Becky, a kind white girl with whom she exchanged notes during one of her classes. In their notes, Becky and Gloria establish a sort of friendship, swapping tales about regular teenage stuff. On paper, they were just girls who shared the same interests, but the parameters of their relationship were clear. When Gloria wrote one day to ask whether she could speak if she saw Becky in the halls, Becky responded, "No, please don't." They both knew the consequences for Becky would be great. But Gloria has always felt grateful for those few moments in class when Becky helped her to feel accepted, as though she had at least one ally among her white classmates. The kindness of students like Becky sailed under the radar because to be detected was to draw harassment their own way, to be dubbed by the loudmouthed segregationists a nigger lover and thus the enemy. In this battle, the segregationists forced everybody to choose sides. If you weren't with them all the way in words and deeds, there was no middle ground. You were against them. Even administrators as methodical and by the book as Mrs. Huckabee, Mr. Powell, and Jess Matthews ended up on their hit list. The segregationists were taking names, and they were determined to make the lives of their enemies as miserable as they tried to make all nine of ours. The majority of students at Central fell into the third group, those who kept silent. They wanted all the trouble to end. They did not torment us, but they didn't extend themselves to us in any way either, not even quietly. They did not want to be associated with one side or the other. They chose to remain neutral, as if remaining neutral in the face of evil were an acceptable and just choice. They turned away. They rendered us invisible. They most likely, the ones today, when asked about the class of 1957, tried to reinvent history. Things at Central weren't as bad as the nine of us have said, they have recalled in recent years. The mobs weren't as big, they say. The bad guys and gals weren't as bad, and the atmosphere wasn't as tense. Well, of course, that is how they remember the Central Journey these 50-plus years later. When I was suffering in those hallowed halls, they turned away. They did nothing. They said nothing. They chose not to see. There was another group, a small group, for sure, but in my mind, the bravest of all. Those teachers and students who at times were openly kind, who seemed to look beyond skin color and see 9 students eager to learn, eager to be part of a great academic institution. Mr. Bell, my biology teacher, was one of them. He was young, but he seemed worldly and wise. His mother taught me Spanish, but even in her body language said she resented my presence at the school. Her son, however, had fought in the Korean War and had seen life far beyond Little Rock. He kept an eye on me in class and kept the troublemakers at bay. He didn't single me out, but he called on me about as regularly as he called on my classmates. He even encouraged me to participate in the science fair. He chose to see me. There were others too. The yearbook from my 10th grade year included kind notes from more than a dozen white classmates who risk harassment for taking even that small step. My exchanges with some of them have disappeared from my memory, but their words will forever remind me that there were moments in the midst of chaos when black and white faded and we were just teenagers. Liz Dolan's locker was a couple of doors down from mine, and we were also in the same gym class. Sometimes, as we stood at our lockers, the two of us swapped tales about our favorite show, American Bandstand. Liz was a dancer on the Little Rock version in the evenings. And as she hurriedly gathered her things in the evening, she mentioned that she was rushing to get to the local television station. I'd wish her good luck and compliment her on the next day on her dance moves. Robin Woods, a junior, was Terry's friend first. Terry had come to class one day with no book, and as he sat there looking lost, Robin pulled her chair next to his and offered to share her book. She wrote in my yearbook, "Dear Carlotta, this has been a memorable year for all of us. Just wish you didn't have so many unhappy ones. Remember, I am for you, and good luck to a really great girl." Then there was Jenny Lee Ball, a dark-haired girl who always wore her shoulder-length hair pulled back in a ponytail. She was on the student council, and we shared gym, which usually involved some type of team activity, softball, basketball, or even gymnastics. For obvious reasons, the gym teacher set up the teams in the early part of the school year, which seemed to work fine. But eventually, the teacher chose team captains, who got to select their own teams. Whenever Jenny was captain, she always chose me. Maybe the gym teacher had encouraged her to do so. Jenny was, after all, a student government representative. I'll never know for sure. But my name wasn't the first one Jenny called, and neither was it the last. And there wasn't a hint of scorn or regret when she boldly called out my name. When our team got into the huddle to discuss our gymnastics formation, a pyramid that first day, Jenny included me in the discussion. What was I good at? Where should I fit? Was I strong enough to hold down the bottom? I remember Jenny as befriending me, though I can't think of a special thing she said or did that was particularly special. But I guess that was the point. I saw nothing in her eyes and heard nothing in her tone that suggested she thought I was special or different. She just treated me with the same consideration and dignity she showed everybody else. That's all I ever really wanted. That's all every one of us wanted. And each time I encountered a rare soul who seemed to recognize that, I considered it a real blessing. Chapter 10 is an explosive night. When I made it to my bedroom the night of February 9th, 1960, it was raining mud. At least that's how it appeared to me when I heard heavy rain and wind slapping against the house. I looked up at the window and saw thick droplets of rain mixed with red dirt sliding down the window panes. It was about 9:30, my favorite time of the night. I savored those moments of solitude just before bedtime when I got to unwind, listen to the radio, and think. The house was quiet. Daddy hadn't come in yet from his nighttime job at Big Daddy's place. Luana and Tina, then 11 and 4, were asleep in their room a few steps up the hall, and Mother was in her and Daddy's room near the front door. I clicked on the clock radio resting on the nightstand. The AM dial was already tuned to one of my favorite stations, WLAC, which broadcasts nightly from Nashville. It was one of a few white stations that brought the soulful sounds of black rock and roll, rhythm and blues, and jazz artists. The Platters, Little Richard, Fats Domino, and Etta James, to places they had never been before, the homes and lives of my white peers throughout the nation. It tickled me when I imagined that maybe some of my white classmates at Central were listening secretly too. I particularly enjoyed a program called Randy's Record Highlights, which aired shortly after 10 o'clock. As I changed into my pajamas, my mind felt at ease. I had made it to the home stretch at Central, I thought. For weeks, things had been calm. No protesters or major incidents, and graduation was less than 4 months away. I'd finally stopped sulking after the rejection from Antioch and decided on a college. My decision-making process had been quite simple. I accepted the first school that wrote to me with good news after the big letdown, Michigan State. Michigan State wanted me right then, and I was eager to be wanted. After such disappointment, I had been in no mood to wait and hear from my second and third choices. By the time the acceptance letters came from Brandeis and the University of California, I had already settled on going to Michigan. I was even starting to get excited. I liked the idea of getting lost among the thousands of students on campus. I got to come and go as I pleased, and no one would even notice. Finally, I would have a normal life. Dances, concerts, football games, maybe even a boyfriend. I'd missed out on so much at Central. I could hardly wait to end this chapter of my life and start anew. But for the moment, it was bedtime. I clicked off the light in my room, crawled into bed with my thoughts, and let Etta and Fats serenade me to sleep. No sooner had I closed my eyes, it seemed, than I was shaken by a thunderous boom. The house shook, and I could hear glass crashing to the floor in the front of the house. I sat up quickly with my hands gripping the sides of my bed as if to steady the room. For a moment, I felt frozen in place. My eyes, wide with fear, darted around the pitch-black room. What was that? Was I dreaming? The explosion had come from the front. Then, oh my God, my little sisters, Mother. I had to find them. I leaped out of bed, and as soon as my bare feet landed on the cold floor, I took off running through my bedroom. My first stop was the den just outside my bedroom door. It was eerily dark and still, and I turned toward the hall and ran up to the front of the house. I was halfway up the hall when I saw Luana and Tina standing in their nightgowns with Mother in her bedroom door at the other end of the hall. When I reached them, Mother and the girls looked dazed and bewildered, but unhurt. We stared at one another, too shaken to even speak. Little Tina's eyes moved quickly from mother to me, searching our faces for clues. A haze of smoke floated through the darkness from the living room on the hallway where we stood. The smoke hurt my eyes, and an unfamiliar scent filled the air. It smelled as if something had blown up in a chemistry lab. Inside, I was trembling. I felt helpless and horrified, and I needed Daddy. He would tell me everything would be okay and make me feel safe. But he must have been working late. It was 11, and he hadn't yet made it home. I suddenly felt a painful sense of a responsibility, as though I needed to step up and somehow make the situation right. But I didn't know how. I could feel real panic rising in my throat. I had the odd thought that the stoic Carlotta, the one who always felt her hard work and smarts would make everything okay, who had believed that anything was possible if she stood firm and stayed strong, was now at a total loss. The sound of my mother's voice quelled my panic. She was calm and restrained, but I heard helplessness too. "Call your daddy," she said. I'd like to stop there. I hope that some of what I have read would be of some interest to you. This is my first time kind of doing this, so I'd like to thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming here and making this room so full.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.